So we've been investigating a wide range of micronutrients that impact on DNA damage, and we certainly know that folate and B12 are important in deficiency to cause this. We have noticed and we've shown data that even moderate deficiencies in folate, for example, cause as much DNA damage with this index as that induced by carcinogenic doses of radiation. And we are confident of these results because this same test is actually used for biological dosimetry in people exposed to radiation. So we can use the same test that measures the impact of environmental factors on DNA damage to investigate the impact of malnutrition. Now, in this particular slide, what we did was we determined the effect of dietary intake of a range of micronutrients on this biomarker of DNA damage. And what you are seeing here is what happens in people who have a higher intake of micronutrients on their DNA damage index. And what you can see is that intake of more vitamin E, calcium, folate, retinol, and nicotinic acid is associated with a lower level of damage in people. With beta carotene, a little some intake is good, but too much may not be. And riboflavin, pantothenate, and biotin in excess is associated with more damage. So this tells us something about the dietary patterns of foods that are rich or deficient in these micronutrients and how they could impact on DNA damage in a person and in populations. So this information is now being used to design dietary patterns or foods, functional foods or supplements, to increase or optimize, rather, the intake of those micronutrients that are shown here to be protected. Next slide. Now, in this slide, what I have shown is because this is not an active slide, you can't see it at the top because it's covered by two the question and answer. But what you see here is the amount of these micronutrients that are beneficial in different foods. And each bar is indicative of the amount. Within each bar, you see different colors. And the colors relate to the level of micronutrient in that food. And what you can see, there's a large variation in the foods which are rich in these micronutrients and those which aren't. So, for example, beef and bananas are quite low in these micronutrients, while other foods like almonds, wheat bran, cheddar cheese, and broccoli are rich in these micronutrients. So the choices we make and the dietary patterns we choose to eat can readily make us either adequate or deficient in these important micronutrients. Now, which dietary pattern will work for your genotype depends on the nutriome, which is a term we've coined to relate to the mixture of micronutrients in the foods that you prefer to eat, which is also genetically determined. Whether a polypill of these micronutrients causes benefit is being explored at the moment, and we will have that data sometime next year. Next slide. What is interesting now on the next slide is new data that's coming out suggesting that also lifestyle impacts on this DNA damage biomarker, which is very well validated. This is, in our view, the most validated biomarker at this point in time because it's been associated not only with nutrition in cross-sectional studies, but also when we intervene, this biomarker changes. And generally speaking, DNA is actually very sensitive to changes in nutrition. We also know that this biomarker is related to disease states, both in case control studies as well as prospectively, that it predicts who is going to get, who has a higher risk of developing, let's say, cancer or cardiovascular disease. Now, in this slide, this is a study done in Japan by Morimoto's group. What they did was they measured, they got this so-called HPI index, health promotion index, which is a measure of a number of items relating to lifestyle. So whether you smoke, drink, whether your diet is a good diet, whether it's nutritionally balanced, whether you exercise or don't, whether you sleep adequately or not, whether you work too much or not, whether you think that you are mentally or psychologically stressed, and whether you skip breakfast or not. And the bottom line is that those people who had more of the good habits indicated by a higher HPI index had lower DNA damage. And of those items, there certainly sleeping, exercise, working time, and nutritional balance were particularly important. So in trying to translate this knowledge into practice, we also take into consideration, apart from the nutritional aspects, which are important, also lifestyle aspects, as indicated here. Now, one of the lifestyle aspects is definitely relevant to the Australian and New Zealand way of life is alcohol. And alcohol is one of the most well-established factors that is also important in our diet because we drink alcohol with the food we eat. We know certainly that alcohol will increase biomarkers of DNA damage, including micronuclei. But it's particularly relevant because we understand very well the genetics of alcohol metabolism. Now, what really causes damage is not necessarily alcohol itself, but to some degree alcohol does cause damage directly, but its metabolite acetaldehyde is actually a class 1 carcinogen. And if you don't metabolize alcohol properly, which means if you convert alcohol efficiently to acetaldehyde, but you do not detoxify it by converting it to acetate, then acetaldehyde accumulates, and this is more likely to happen if you drink a lot of alcohol in one session, let's say. This is certainly one aspect that we can translate into practice. We can study the genotype of people. We can determine whether they are going to be more susceptible to generate acetaldehyde, and we can make recommendations on this basis. And this is just one example. Next slide. Okay, and in this next slide, this is a study actually done in Japan, for example, showing that the DNA damage index that we are measuring now in people on a routine basis is increased in habitual drinkers versus non-drinkers, and more so if they are unable to detoxify alcohol. So what we have actually done, we've taken these concepts, next slide please, and developed this idea. So basically the idea that we are working from is that damage to the genome is the most fundamental pathology or disease. Because we know that as damage to DNA increases, then the risk for developmental and degenerative diseases increases. So we have developed this concept that in this new era of preventive and integrative medicine, we should be diagnosing the DNA damage levels in people, in individuals, relating that to their nutrient status and genotype, and using this knowledge that we are accumulating to our nutrigenomic expert advice system, provide recommendations to individuals to alter their dietary patterns, perhaps include functional foods that are rich in nutrients required for genome stability, and maybe their lifestyle, to optimize genome health. But more importantly, that these recommendations are actually the impact of these recommendations are verified on an individual basis by measuring DNA damage before and after the recommendation is made. Now, this is very important because we're in a situation where recommendations are being made to people, but the impact of those recommendations on the genome health is not being investigated. And therefore, neither the practitioners nor the consumer know whether they're having a beneficial impact on their DNA, which is absolutely critical. So the idea of the Genome Health Clinical Summit was published. A story was made, a DNA doctor story, which attracted a lot of interest from health practitioners. A group of doctors in Adelaide contacted CSIRO, and an agreement has been established between this group of doctors and CSIRO in a collaborative way. CSIRO, through this agreement, provides the diagnostics and advice to the doctors, who then make the recommendations to the patients. We provide the DNA damage diagnostics and interpret the data. Now, this concept has been translated into practice through a company called Reach 100, which is described on the next slide. And this slide basically tells you how the operation works. The Reach 100 was launched in July 2007. The Reach 100 doctors interact with clients to explain the genome health test. They provide the nutritional and lifestyle advice based on baseline data of nutritional status and DNA damage, verify with a second test that DNA damage is actually decreased and if not, further adjustments to recommendations are made. whilst the CSIRO would perform the DNA damage test, we interpret the results, we provide a scientific update on dietary lifestyle and genetic variables affecting DNA damage, and we build a de-identified genome health nutrigenomics database to further develop our knowledge and better inform the doctors and the clients about our outcomes. Now, the clinic in Adelaide has been operational since 2007. It has attracted interest internationally and has now been taken up also in one of a recently established integrative and preventive medicine hospital at Kachon-Gil Medical Center in Seoul in Korea. And Reach 100 is also going to be available in Sydney in 2010. Next slide, please. Oh, no, I think this is the last slide.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And then finally, I'm just going to pass on to Lynette, who's going to tell us a little bit about the work being done in New Zealand. Lynette?
Okay, so you've got a very good international perspective. And I think the point is that the dietitians have been telling us for years that, you know, they can give good advice, what they see as good advice, what we've all traditionally seen as good advice, and certainly a number of people will respond, but there's always been a proportion of people whom the dietitians have actually thought must be cheating because they really aren't responding in the way they anticipate. And I think the sort of techniques we're using are trying to ask the question, assuming they aren't actually cheating, of why, and how we can monitor it and how we can actually help these people and at an early stage get their health looking better. Now, Nutrigenomics New Zealand has been going really since 2004, where the Foundation for Research and Technology recognised that this field was important, and it was important that New Zealand got themselves into it. So really, it's a group of individuals, 60 members right across the country, so working between Auckland, Hamilton, Palmerston North, Christchurch and Dunedin, funded by FORCE, but we're taking a slightly different approach. We're working not on a health target but a disease target, so we're looking at inflammatory bowel disease, and it seems for some reason that Crohn's disease in New Zealand is as high as anywhere else in the world, if not higher. And so certainly in Canterbury, one in 325 people have this. So it's not super common, but it's certainly not a rare disease. And it's a really nasty one because they develop often in teenage years this really quite debilitating inability to eat food comfortably, gastric distension, they've got diarrhea, they've got a whole pile of really quite debilitating symptoms. And the doctors can treat it, but what's become clear, one of the reasons why we thought it was a good example, was that if you look in twins, just because you've got a twin with Crohn's disease doesn't mean you're going to get it, but there's a 40 to 50% chance that you will, and it means that diet and genome are sort of interactively working. So it makes it a very good example, and it makes the people with the disease very, very committed. They really want to do something about it. They don't want to be on medication for their lifetime. So this is really the current situation. They're diagnosed by colonoscopy, often as teenagers. They might be advised to restrict their diet. They might be advised to restrict their lifestyle. But generally, the solutions at the moment are quite invasive pharmaceutics for lifetime or surgery, and often they'll sort of start off on a sort of pharmaceutical regime, which is reasonably toxic, and then they'll progress downhill from there to surgery. They suffer often extra intestinal manifestations. So this isn't a nice disease. Now, what's really exciting about it is that we've started to recognise what the genes are that are involved in both forms of IBD, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. There's a lot of overlap. They're not identical, but what we're recognising is that they fall into different pathways, and if you understand the nature of the genes, then it gives you some ideas about how you might recommend specific diets for people with different types of disease, and you class them genetically. So it really is an area that, since we were working on it in 2004, I think we've come up with quite a number of ways. Depending on the gene type, it isn't a one size fits all. We can't go out and say we have got the ultimate diet for Crohn's disease, because what we've got to do is understand their genotype. So what we believe, we're not doing it yet, but we believe it's possible with the technologies that are out there now, is that when they're diagnosed, we think they should actually go immediately onto a multivitamin and mineral, because a lot of these people, malnutrition is part of the problem, and I don't think the doctors are necessarily recognising it. And I think they should have a DNA test. And I think at this stage, we're already in a situation where we can start to make some better recommendations that have been made than in the past. We certainly know that there are elements of the lifestyle that have got to be stopped, and I think we can reduce the pharma need for invasive drugs. But what we want to get to is a situation in the future where we're taking people who've got the disease. So in other words, what we're doing is we're doing testing of babies, say, from Crohn's disease families. We're getting DNA from them, and we're identifying the genes before they develop their disease. And we hope they never do develop the disease. We get them onto the diet that's going to prevent it and stop this inflammation from being triggered. Our hope is that we can use the sort of biomonitoring tools that Mike has been talking about to keep a close eye on these people without getting into the nasty situation where they develop the disease. It's already quite widely being done overseas, where you just send away a buccal swab and a sort of diet information toolkit, and send that back to your doctor or your DNA centre, and then you can get that out there. So we believe this has got enormous potential. We think it's exciting that New Zealand's in there. And so just to really show you the number of people, there's a lot of really very exciting people. It's across these organisations, and it's funded by the Foundation for Research, Science and Technology. So that's it from me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. All right. I'm just unmuting everybody, and I'll open the floor up to questions. Who's got some questions?
I do. Branwyn from Sydney. I have a question for Lynette, please. Can you hear me, Lynette?
Yes, I can.
Okay. When you said about having a DNA test immediately after someone is diagnosed with Crohn's, and then you said what you wanted to do is get to the point where you can give a specific diet and then monitor people, biomonitor them, what exactly are you looking for? What biomarkers in particular?
We'd probably be looking for slightly different sorts of biomarkers from what Michael is looking at.
Yeah.
We'd be looking for early markers of inflammation. What we know is that inflammation, which is obviously what they're suffering from, increases. And you can get some very early molecules that we know are associated with early signs that it's starting to get away. If we see they're starting to develop inflammation, then we go back, we look very closely at their diet, we make more specific recommendations. We might try to help them come up with alternatives, perhaps, if they're getting a bit bored with their diet, and just work much more intensively with them than the dietitians are at the moment.
So these are inflammatory markers in the general blood supply?
Either in the blood or in the urine. Some of the urinary markers are possibly rather easier, rather than having to go in for a blood test. Sending a urine sample to the lab may well be a way. There certainly seems evidence that in mice, we don't know about in man yet, that we can pick up quite a lot of the information we need by going to a mouse experiment, by a urine experiment.
Are you please able to give them names of some of those inflammatory markers in the urine?
you're really challenging me here, because I am not a metabolomics expert, and I can't for the life of me think of the name of the... We've published on them.
Okay.
Look for Daryl Rowan, D-A-R-Y-L, Rowan, R-O-W-A-N, and a couple of recent papers in the Journal of Proteome Research, and that identifies some of them. I'm sorry, I'm going to embarrass myself if I try to give a name, so I'm better not to give one.
That's fine, but presumably those same inflammatory markers in mice would be what you'd pick up in humans.
We anticipate, so certainly the pathways that are being indicated as important and triggered at an early stage are ones that occur in humans, so we have every reason to believe. They're more complex in humans because obviously they've got a much more of a mixed diet. You can't, it's not like a mouse, you can put them on a cage and make sure that you know exactly what they're eating and drinking.
Sure.
So it's harder with humans.
Okay, thank you.
Right, any other questions?
It's Karen here. I've got a question for Lynette as well. Lynette, you gave some figures for Canterbury, but do you know how many sufferers there are of Crohn's disease in New Zealand?
I don't know the figures across the country. I do know, though, that in Auckland, probably our figures are a bit like Canterbury's, and we seem to have one of the highest incidences of paediatric Crohn's and Crohn's in young adults. And so a lot of the people we've been working with are really quite young, and it really is for a young, sensitive teenager, you know, going out on their first date and having to go to the toilet 24 times, one of them described to me, it's a pretty traumatic sort of thing. So it's a really nasty age group to get in it. And the people at Auckland Hospital, there was a paper in the New Zealand Medical Journal last year, Simon Shin, I think, was the senior author, that described the incidents there and described the symptoms, and it's not good news.
Lynette, is that the Pākehā population or New Zealand as a whole with that high incidence of paediatric Crohn's?
It's New Zealand as a whole. It does seem, though, that the Pākehā is most common in them. Mm-hmm. It does seem that the Māori population particularly don't seem to have one of the common genes. And so although we have seen it in Māori people, mm-hmm. They haven't got this NOD2 mutation, which is a bacterial sensing one. Mm-hmm. So it occurs, but it may be a slightly different mechanism.
Okay. Lynette, would that figure be about the same for Wellington as well, then, that you've given for Canterbury?
I haven't seen the figures for Wellington, so I can't comment. But it does vary probably about two or threefold across the country. We are still, as a country, really on the high side, and I just don't understand why.
All right. Any other questions?
Branwyn with a question for Michael, yep. Please. Michael, you mentioned about the damage to the genome. Are there any damage hotspots? Or is it particularly random?
Yeah, well, it is probable that there would be damage hotspots depending which micronutrient is in deficiency or excess. So, for example, folate deficiency would cause altered methylation in repeat sequences, for example.
Folate deficiency, altered methylation, okay.
Yeah, altered methylation, and there's increasing evidence that it also might be associated with shorter telomeres, which are the ends of chromosomes.
Yes, okay.
Whilst other deficiencies that might, maybe deficiencies in some micronutrients required for antioxidant defense,
mm-hmm.
Might result in a higher exposure to reactive oxygen species,
mm-hmm.
which would cause random damage in the genome.
Okay.
Right. So it's probable that there are going to be some differences.
Right.
But yeah. So what we're hoping that in the future, we might get a fingerprint that would be of DNA damage that would be indicative of a particular profile of deficiency or specific deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Right. Any last questions? Anybody?
I just wanted to ask quickly, Lynn, where would Kieran be able to get some statistics for Crohn's disease on a national level? Would that be Ministry of Health?
I would assume so, but I would actually look for this paper in the New Zealand Medical Journal. I know that Simon Chin was one of the authors of it. So I would look for the New Zealand Medical Journal. I can't remember whether it was 2008 or 2009, but they actually had the paediatric figures right across the country. They divided it into areas. It's very pictorially illustrated, and it really also illustrates the symptoms and why it's such such a problem. So I think if you could find that one, email me if you can't find it, and I can send it to you. To me, that's a really good starting point.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks, Peter and Lynette.
Thanks.
Excellent. Well, I think I'm going to wrap the briefing up then. Thank you, firstly, to our panelists for their brilliant knowledge of the subject and for sharing their time with us. I know they're very busy with the conference at the moment. And thank you as well to everyone who phoned in. We hope that you found it as interesting as we did. Just to remind everyone again that the slides will go up in the resource library and the audio will be posted up on the web shortly. All right. Thank you very much and goodbye, everyone.